Welcome back to another episode of the Positive Persistence Podcast, where we bring you stories to inspire you and strategies to help you tap into your potential and become your best self. I'm your host, Ian Bowen, and today I am so excited because I am joined by internationally known motivational speaker, author, and happiness coach, Kim Strobel. Kim, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Ian. I love the name of the podcast. It's right in line with everything that I seek out in life. So I'm happy to be here.
That is awesome. I know that we touch base offline and that you feel that bios are boring, but I have to give our listeners and our viewers a little backstory if they don't know who you are. So here we go. So for over 20 years, Kim has been a teacher, top-tier leadership consultant, and nationally recognized speaker who helps others rediscover their meaning, purpose, and passion. During her 20-year education career, she's partnered with people at all levels to implement innovative and inspirational practices in the classroom, increase academic achievement, and create positive school-wide climates. On top of running her education consulting company, she's also a happiness coach and is deeply passionate about empowering others to live bigger, bolder, braver lives. And because of her own challenges and adversities, Kim teaches others how to overcome their fears, discover their joy, activate their potential, and boldly pursue a life that feels good to them from the inside out. She is results-focused and believes in giving people the tools to make permanent and enduring positive changes in all areas of their lives. And Kim, that is anything but boring. Wow. Holy cow.
Well, thank you, Ian. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So it is such a joy and a pleasure for me to have you on the show, just because I think that we are very like-minded in a lot of areas. But I want to dig in to your story. I want to talk about your book, and I'm going to pop this up here. So everybody, you've got to read this book. I mean, it is literally a page turner. Like, I was smiling the entire time reading it, and I couldn't wait to talk to Kim about it. So we're going to get into that too. But if you could give our listeners and our viewers a little bit of your backstory dealing with anxiety and misdiagnosis and panic disorder and the story that kind of shaped the beginning of your life, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. As you probably read, I think it's in chapter one of Teach Happy. I have always been an anxious personality, but when I was a sophomore in high school, I was sitting in my English language arts class. And, at that time in my life, Ian, I just like really embraced who I was. Like, I had confidence. I was kind of in my small hometown, you know, a star athlete. I had a lot going for me, big dreams, big goals, big ambitions, couldn't wait to, you know, graduate and go to IU. And then from there, move to a big city and just had tons of goals. And I've always been wired that way. But I was sitting in my English language arts class, and within like a second, my whole body started to shake. I had these feelings of extreme terror and dread come over me. I was sweating. I was near unconsciousness. I felt like I was going to faint. The walls were closing in. I felt disoriented. It's like 76 symptoms came at me in a matter of a second, which we actually know now that when a person feels those symptoms come on, it's 1/14th of a second. That's how fast they come on. And so I like ran to the nurse's office and just said, I don't feel right. Like, I feel funny, you know, shaking all over. And really, Ian, there's like so much to this whole story. But from age 16 till about age 24, my life became extremely limited because I was having these episodes and no one knew in the late 80s. No one knew about really anxiety disorders or what was wrong with me. I got a diagnosis of seizure disorder. Then I got a diagnosis of hypoglycemia, low blood sugar. And the bottom line is I became so fearful of these symptoms, of these episodes, that I began to constantly monitor, how do I feel? Do I feel weird? Do I feel funny? Am I shaking? Am I sweating? Am I confused? Do I know my name? Like, I started to be hyper-vigilant with it, which just caused more and more and more of these attacks, to where I just did not feel safe in my brain or body anymore. And I was really, for the next 8 years, I lived in a cage. I struggled to do the most simplest of things. I struggled to drive my car 5 minutes to work by myself every morning. I struggled to walk around the block by myself. I struggled to go to the grocery store, which was like a mile and a half away. Just driving there felt like pure terror, and walking in there. And so it was like there was this inner Kim who was full of drive, ambition, and confidence. And then all of a sudden, it was like, I always said the outside of me just did not match up to the inside. And really every 15 minutes of every day became just a fight for my life, Ian. Just like, even now I feel like I feel good today, right? I just feel normal. I'm in my house. I'm by myself. I feel safe. I don't feel like I'm about to like lose my mind or have to be called 911 in a second because I don't feel right in my head. Like things that people don't think about, for me, all I wanted to do was feel safe.
Yeah.
And I couldn't. And so I really had this moment, this bath mat rug moment in my little bathroom, where at some point I just really did plead with God. And I said, you know, I just can't do it anymore. And I need you to relieve me of my suffering. And I don't know how to do it. I'm not going to go out and kill myself because like, I don't even know how to do that. I need you to like kill me in a car accident or like somehow just take me out of this suffering.
Right.
And that was like one of the lowest points of my life, Ian, because no part of me wanted to die, but it was honestly too hard to live. And I always tell people that was a pivotal moment. I had some type of reckoning. I either felt or heard some type of message that basically said, get off that bath mat rug, Kim, because you are made for more. And like, let's get this figured out. Let's start taking action. Like, this is not how your life ends. And I always say from there, I got into a wonderful doctor who happened to be studying anxiety disorders. And finally, at 24, I was told, Kim, you're not crazy. You have what's called panic disorder. And this is an anxiety disorder. And now you also have agoraphobia with it, right? Because agoraphobia means that you constantly keep yourself safe and secluded because you don't feel comfortable outside your home, so to speak, mm-hmm. or even in your home with, unless somebody's there.
Right.
And so I always say, like, I got a diagnosis, I got put on an antidepressant, I got put into cognitive behavioral therapy with a psychologist, which was critical to me doing the work. And I would say that the third thing is that around that time, the personal development field was coming to fruition. And I started to get my hands on books that taught me how to work on the inside of who Kim Strobel was, who to peel away those layers, to actually take action day in and day out, to overcome my fears, to overcome my limitations. And Ian, I started to see that when I was willing to do the work on the inside of who I was, mm-hmm. I started to see that there were major things that started to change in my life. And so now I tell people, you know, some might even say I have an obsession with personal growth. And I do. Yeah. I'm 50 years old and I am constantly reading stuff that says, this is how you get even better, Kim Strobel. And I just feed off of it.
That is, it's evident, because as you were talking about your own journey and self-improvement books and reading those things, your energy just shot off the chart. You could see that it was coming from a place of joy and happiness. And that is awesome. So would it be fair to say that, you know, the convergence of the self-help field and some of the medication that you were on and meeting that doctor was really pivotal in kind of releasing you from the prison, if you will, that you were in?
Yeah. And, you know, it released me because of that pain and that suffering and that limitation. as awful as it was, and to be honest with you, Ian, I still at times have had struggles. It's not like it all went away.
Yeah.
You know, it flared up at different times in my life and scared me again. But for me, I just think that I can see that that particular circumstance or moment allowed me to really step into, and you and I talked about this, the power of who Kim Strobel is and can be. Mm-hmm. And I always say, you know, God has a funny sense of humor, Ian. How do you take the girl who couldn't walk to her mailbox and say, now I'm going to put you on a stage with 6,000 people and you're going to do the number one thing that even normal people are afraid of?
Right.
But it's because I have such a strong message to share, I think. And again, I'm not a guru and I don't have it all figured out, but I can tell you that if you are willing to work on your mindset, and you and I talked about this before we started, I loved your analogy of the mindset and the heart, the getting those two aligned. It is unbelievable what a person can uncover about their full potential.
Yeah. And you are a shining example of that. And yeah, it's just amazing to hear your story and to see what you've been able to accomplish and on the way, taking the steps to becoming the best version of yourself, which we all know that that is a journey that never ends.
It isn't. And I just want to say, like, I live by that quote or whatever, that like, you are your biggest investment, but people, they don't sometimes know how or even extend enough self-love to themselves to know that they are allowed to invest in themselves.
Yeah. Wow. Can you say that again? Because that's pretty powerful.
Yeah. So I say or have heard, you are your biggest investment, mm-hmm. which means that out of everybody in this world, there's no one else you should be pouring into more than you pour into yourself. And people struggle to do that because one, I think you have to have self-love, which is probably one of the number one blocks that gets in a lot of people's ways, is that they don't love themselves and know that they deserve that time. They deserve that intention. They deserve yes. that action.
Yes.
And two, they don't always know how to do it. So I feel like that's where the book Teach Happy kind of comes into play, because it's kind of the blueprint for how I've really been able to increase my own happiness and well-being levels. And when I learned to do that, I felt like I shifted the needle in every area of my life.
Yeah, that's awesome. In the book Teach Happy, Small Steps to Big Joy, again, and reading this book, my assumption is that is pointed towards teachers, towards educators. However, reading this book, there are so many pearls of wisdom that apply to every walk of life, which is why I love this book and the message within it so much. And who doesn't need some more happiness in their life, right?
Yeah. Ian, I love the words teach happy, because when I wrote it, it was at first for an education publisher, and I felt like the teachers that I serve are struggling in a very demanding and overwhelming position. But as I began to write it, it's like 99% of the book is applicable to every human being. Yes. So sometimes I feel like, I mean, only 1% is like a teacher example here and there. So I feel like the title, I worry that it gets in the way of people outside of the education system getting it into their hands. So I appreciate that you brought that up, that it does appear to be just for teachers.
Yeah, this book, everybody needs to read this book. Parents, teachers, and everybody.
We all need to get happier, Ian. We don't know how to do it. But yeah. Let me tell you what, I know how to do it now.
Well, there are so many strategies and tips in the book. But I want to break down something that you mentioned just in chapter 2, when you talk about understanding contributors to happiness. And you quote Arthur Brooks, mm-hmm. who I believe is in the positive psychology field and teaches it at Harvard, which When I saw that phrase, positive psychology, I didn't even know that was a field of study. And I was like, this is a thing? Like, okay, yes, let's go. I need some more of this. That is awesome. So you say, or you quote Arthur by saying, happiness has three major ingredients: enjoyment, satisfaction, and purpose. And then you go on to say that you believe that happiness is how much of those three ingredients we actually feel in our lives and how we can feel more of them. So my question, Kim, is how do we allow ourselves to feel more enjoyment, satisfaction, and purpose in our lives?
Yes. Well, I feel like sometimes people feel like they're supposed to have this giant purpose, or they're like, I don't even know what my purpose is. Or some of them don't even, like, maybe they don't have a career, but that doesn't mean they don't have a purpose. I mean, they may be serving a purpose in their family, you know, as mothers. And, you know, so I just feel like purpose means that I have a vision for my life and I know how to serve in that vision. I'm a servant of that vision. And I think we have lots of different purposes, but, you know, sometimes, especially people when they retire, you know how they'll retire and they just go downhill really fast.
Yes.
It's because they no longer have a purpose.
Right.
And so I feel like I will be 90 years old, Ian, and I will still have a purpose for serving others. Mm-hmm. It might be that I'm going to make sure that I'm extremely kind and that I smile and greet every person that day. Then that's my purpose for the day. But I have lots of purposes. I save dogs. I feel like I empower people. I feel like I'm really there for educators. And I would be lost if I didn't have these directions, something that I'm working on in my life. And then enjoyment is something that we forget we're allowed to do. Like, when I do, I think you remember the life will activity that I did in one of the chapters, mm-hmm. where we talk about how there's all these kind of eight components. So it's like there's the three, but we can break those out into these eight components of what leads a fulfilling life. And one of those is fun and recreation. Mm-hmm. Play. Do you play in your life? Because we are biologically wired to play, even as adults, but we think that play is frivolous, that we were only supposed to do it as children. And so play can mean, for me, play means taking a run 4 out of 7 days a week and doing my gym workout the other 3 days, which, by the way, I don't really like my gym workout, but I just forced myself to do it. I'll be real honest about that. That's another whole story. Right. But I had to shift my mindset, Ian. Talk about mindset work. You know, play can be hiking. Play can be reading books. Play can be creating, building, crafting. But like, you're allowed to do that in your adult life. And what we know about people who play, or people who have a sense of enjoyment and fun in their lives, they're much happier people.
Yeah.
And then the third one was life satisfaction, which is, do you feel a sense of satisfaction in your life? And if you don't, let's not play victim to that. Let's step into warrior mode. What is it that you need to do differently to change, to work on, so that you begin to have moments of life satisfaction and feeling good? And it all starts from the inside out, right? Like, happiness is it's from the inside out. It has nothing to do with what kind of car you drive, what kind of money you make, what kind of home you live in. It has very little to do with those things. So I feel like that's important. And it's also that happiness, Arthur Brooks also says, happiness is like a direction that we're headed in. It's not like, oh, you do all of these things and now Kim has finally arrived at happiness and she's happy. I'm like a mixture of happy and unhappy every day, Ian.
Yes. Totally understand that. And I love the fact that you talked about play. And in the book, you talk about how important it is to play, but you also make the distinction that it's okay and encouraged to play like a child, but don't get it twisted. That doesn't mean that you have to be childish.
Yes. But I can admit I'm kind of childish at times. So let me give you an example. My friends are more like, some of my friends are more serious in nature. So like, even when they were parents, like they like to play board games or they like to make crafts with their kid. Where I wasn't like that. I didn't like it, those things. I'm the one that's outside on the basketball court shooting hoops with them or pitching a ball because like that's more of my play personality. But yes. Ian, I will tell you one of my favorite types of play, and this is going to sound a little crazy, but I don't care. So I have three dogs and I married Mr. Laidback. So I always say I'm the girl who runs 40 miles a week, takes anti-anxiety medicine, meditates 40 minutes a day, and like I'm still pretty wound up. And then I married like Mr. Laidback. Of course I did. And he's a saint. But like every evening, I literally run around my house like a little kid. I hide under tables. I climb under the covers. I get behind the curtains and I literally play hide and seek with my dogs. And the dogs are loud and they're barking and they're chasing me and I'm chasing them. And it's like it rejuvenates my soul. And it's so funny because my husband has now like made a rule. Like that he would really prefer that I only do that when he goes and does his gym workout in the evenings, because he just doesn't want any of that chaos in his life. Right.
Yeah. Well, that's great. He allows you to have the space to play.
Yes, he does. He does. And like I said, my play personality is different than somebody else's, you know?
Yeah. But the play analogy is so true. I'm like, we have five boys, the youngest being seven. Almost eight. And, you know, when he's out just playing around and you watch them playing together, it's like there's no other care in the world other than what they're doing in that moment. And they're happy because they're just out, they're moving their bodies, they're outside having a good time. And it's just so, it's just so pure.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You're exactly right. Like as adults, for some reason, we move away from allowing ourselves to feel that happiness. And I don't know. I don't know if it's because we feel that we get to an age where we're, you know, too cool for school and we can't act that way. I don't know what it is, but we definitely move away from that simple pleasure of just having fun.
Yeah. And I'm curious, Ian, because I wrote an entire chapter on play and a lot of it is based on Stuart Brown's 8 play personalities. And I want to know which ones are yours.
Kim, I'll tell you the truth. I felt kind of bad after reading through those because I was like, I don't know how to talk to Kim about this because I don't feel like I match any of those.
You don't? Not even the kinesthete, which is like move your body?
That was the closest. Like in the first sentence, like, okay, yep, that's me. But then I kept reading the description like, maybe that's not me so much. But that would be the closest one of the 8.
Yeah. It's so funny that you say that because maybe Stuart Brown needs to, I'm looking right now, I'm trying to remember all 8, but maybe he needs to expand on that. I would be curious if you ever come up what you think yours might be. I know for me, I was definitely the competitor. So you're not a competitor either, Ian?
Well, yes. I mean, there's a little bit of me in each of those.
I'm gonna have to coach you on this, Ian.
Yeah, there's a little bit of me in each of those, but you know, I'm not, you know, the Joker so much.
Okay.
The Joker, the kinesthetic, the explorer,
yep.
The competitor, the director, the collector, the artist, creator. Now, I definitely have the director, some of those, because I love planning. That's how I am. So my brain works.
Oh, for wow. Sure.
I'm a little bit of the kinesthetic. Not so much the Joker, not so much the creator. So I'm a little bit of a couple, I guess, but there yes. wasn't one that was like, yes, that's
right.
That's
right.
I'm a mix, I guess.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I am definitely not a director, nor am I a collector. But mine were jokes, Joker, competitor, and kinesthetic. Those are my 3.
Yeah. I love the stories of the practical jokes you were talking about in there.
Oh, yeah. We get that playful personality from our dad, my brothers and I. So I think that's genetic or something or environmental.
That's awesome. I wanted to talk to you, Kim, about the premise of your baseline happiness. So you also talk in the book about how each of us have a baseline happiness level or our so-called set point.
Yes.
And then you go on to discuss the principle of hedonic adaptation. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah.
So I was hoping you could explain that some for us.
Yeah. Well, that's one of my favorite things that I teach in the keynote. And The research blew me away around happiness when I learned about it, mostly from Sonia Lubomirsky and Sean Acor. But we all operate with this baseline happiness level. So mine might be in the middle, and maybe Ian, you have a little bit of a higher baseline. So mm-hmm. what happens is that good and bad things happen in our life, and we fluctuate up and down, up and down. But what happens is we always come back to whatever our baseline is. So it might take 2 hours, it might take 2 days, it might take 2 months. But, you know, for example, maybe my husband and I get a new big beautiful home on this acreage that we want, and I get a boost in happiness. I really do. But eventually it's going to just come right back to whatever my baseline is. And the same has been proven through the neuroscience of the brain, is that as human beings, we can endure, you know, adversities, traumas, challenges, illness, mm-hmm. death, all these things. And that for the most part, our brains will reset back to our baseline, which is fascinating to me. But they even did studies, Ian, on quadriplegics. And they found, I forget what the average time was, that they literally reset back to their baseline after, I don't know if it was 2 years. And it's so hard to believe, right? Yeah. But then there's evidence all around me of people that I know who have endured what sometimes would feel like the unimaginable. And while they may carry that grief or that loss with them, it seems like they do create forward momentum in their life. And so then the next question is, well, Kim, why is Ian's baseline maybe higher than yours? And so I tell people to picture a pie chart. And what we know is that 50% of your long-term happiness is genetic. Mm-hmm. And it comes from your mom or dad or a mixture of both. And Ian, when I tell this, I have 80% of the heads in the crowd drop, and they literally whisper, I'm so screwed.
Yeah. When I was reading the book, I was like, oh no.
That's a lot. 50% is genetic, right?
Yes.
But it's how our brains are wired. And some of us come from a mom or a dad or both that have brains that automatically pick up on way more negative than positive.
Oh, man.
And that sounds like a huge amount, and it is, but I believe it's the same reason that some of us can eat McDonald's French fries and like never gain weight, and others of us can look at a McDonald's French fry and we put on 5 pounds, right?
Yeah.
It's just this genetic tendency. But where I find the research gets even more interesting is that we can put every single life circumstance that you've ever had, Ian. What kind of home did you grow up in? Did your parents get divorced or were they married? What kind of money did you have? What kind of childhood experiences did you have? Were you popular? Were you not popular? Were you bullied? Were you not bullied? And then like all the way into adulthood, every external circumstance that a person has had can be thrown into the pie. And the research shows that it only accounts for about 10% of long-term happiness.
These external circumstances.
Yes, these external circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're like Kim Strobel, you let some things that have happened to you, some experiences, or even some people steal way more than 10% of the pie.
Yeah.
For far too long.
Yes.
And I tell people that's a piece that I've had to really work on in my own life. And I have made progress. There's more work to do in that area. But you know, when people have done an injustice to you or wounded you in deep ways, we tend to carry that almost as self-righteousness. Like, I can't let this go. I have to over and over in my brain remind myself how wrong they were and how terrible it was and how could they ever do that to me, when in fact, you're choosing. You are literally choosing to let that person or that situation steal your joy.
Yeah.
And what I had to learn, I had to face a harsh reality, Ian, which was that I've played victim at times in my life, you know, mm-hmm. and that victim mentality gets you nowhere.
Right.
So, yeah. So the life circumstances, they don't account for much. And it's because partly like the term that you read in the book, some people call it hedonic adaption or hedonic adaptation. And what it means is that our brain is automatically wired to quickly adapt to external circumstances. So for example, the analogy I always like to use is picture one of those really cold wintry days up there, especially where you are in the northern part of the state. It's yep. freezing cold, and you walk in and you sit by the fireplace and it feels so incredibly warm and toasty. And then after 2 minutes or so, you're like, okay, it doesn't feel so good anymore. I'm done with that, right? So we have this biological mechanism that says you are, in order to survive, you're going to become a huge adapter and you're going to adapt quickly to everything in your life. So again, we get a positive hit, you know, something good happens in our life. And yeah, it feels really, really good. But then eventually that no longer gives us the dopamine hit. And then we gotta reach for more, which also becomes a problem, right? Because what we do is we move the goalpost in our life. We yes. say, well, if I could just lose 15 pounds, I'd be happier. And you lose the 15 pounds and then you go, you know what? Now I need it to be 20. Like if it's really going to feel good, I need it to be 20. We do it with money. We do it with achievements. It's human nature. All we do is our brain adapts and then we move the goalpost and say, well, now it's, this is what I need to be happy. So, right.
And yeah. that speaks to another term that you used in the book from, I believe it was Sean Acor, about the hedonic treadmill.
Yeah. And right, never enough, right?
Yeah, and that speaks to what you talk about in the book in terms of always chasing the achievement, thinking that that's going to give you happiness. But you have another spin on that.
Yeah, yeah. So we play, I say as humans, we play the what if game with happiness. And so okay. we say, when I lose the weight, when I get married, when I find the right partner, when my paycheck gets bigger, when we earn this as, when we buy the new home, we play this whole like when if game. Mm-hmm. And we say, when those things happen, then I'll be happy. If those things happen, then I'll be happy. And so the issue is, Ian, is that you are tying your own happiness in the now to the achievement of a goal. And Ian, you and I are all about goals. We believe in having goals. We love goals. They're great. They're really wonderful. You should have goals in your life. But the problem is when you're delaying your happiness in the now, because you've tied your happiness to the achievement of the goal, you will be disappointed every single time.
And you never achieve happiness along the way.
You don't have any happiness in the now. Yeah. Right? Yeah. And you know, when I'm going through something really tough in my life, like the other day, I was just like, it was a crappy day. And the last thing I wanted to do was be grateful for anything in my life. I was just like, and so I'm taking my run because that's one of my things that helps me with my headspace. And I'm like, okay, you are literally just going to look for abundance all around you. Oh, wow. Look at all the grass in that field. That's incredible. Like how much grass, look at the leaves on that tree. Like there is blessings and bounty all around me. But I was kind of like inwardly, I was like, this sucks. I don't want to look for anything good right now, you know, but like I forced myself to do it because I had to move myself out of that. Like, you know, I was just in this downward spiral, which is okay, but you've got to like somehow get yourself out of it. And so I guess really that kind of leads to people might be saying, okay, Kim, if 50% is genetic, 50% of your long-term happiness is genetic, and only 10% is your external circumstances, well, that leaves 40% of the pie. And that's the part that for 20 years, Ian, has completely fired me up, because I know from the research that human beings have the ability to increase their happiness levels by up to 40%. And it has to do with these three things, which all scream, Ian, the thoughts you're thinking,
yes,
the actions right. you're taking, and the behaviors that you have or the habits in your life. So thoughts, the thoughts you're thinking, the actions you're taking, and the behaviors or the habits that you have in life. And so I really like to focus on that 40%. That's what the whole book focuses on, is like, okay, what needs to happen so that I can take responsibility for the 40% of happiness that is within my control?
Yes. And there's a passage in here, I'm so glad you mentioned that, that I want to read, because I read this and I was like, yes, this is exactly right. So you say that your thoughts become the beliefs you hold about yourself. A belief is just a repeating thought. Once you get more control over your thoughts, you begin to download new beliefs. When you're operating with a new belief system, this drives you to take different actions and form new habits. Once you have these new habits, you begin to experience a happier life. Boom. That's like mic drop. That's all you need to say. Like, I love that paragraph because that totally sums it up. And it's simple, but it's not easy.
Exactly. Exactly. And the thing is, again, this is why a person has to do the inner work on themselves, whether it's through personal development books, through a therapist. I mean, I've had a therapist, life coach slash therapist in my life for 20 years. And some years I see him twice a year. Some years I see him 8 times a year, because like that's what he does, is he helps me work on those inner belief systems, which, by the way, Ian, most of our beliefs were formed between the ages of 0 and 6. And they were modeled to us from our parents or our caretakers. Right. So you can imagine if you had a parent who was highly critical of you, Ian's like pointing to himself for all those listeners, right? And, yeah, and I'm very loving. Yeah, right. But so like, then there's this part of you, your inner critic is so strong on yourself, and it could cause all kinds of issues as far as like perfectionism, the never enoughness, the senses of worthy and value. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of goes in line with Carol Dweck, who wrote Mindset. Have you read her book, Ian?
I have not.
So she wrote the book Mindset, and she has this quote that says, "The view you adopt for yourself profoundly affects the way you lead your life." I'll say that again. The view you adopt for yourself profoundly affects the way you lead your life. And what the view is, your belief system. Mm-hmm. And so that belief system is monitoring how you show up for yourself. It's monitoring the amount of self-love you're willing to extend to yourself and others. It's showing up in your relationships. It shows up in everything. And so if we don't extract those old downloadable beliefs and replace them with new ones, then we won't be able to really get, you know, the outcomes we want. And Ian, one of them that people carry is people carry a huge money mindset belief. I mean, that's a whole book in itself, right? Yeah. That's why people who win the lottery within 5 years, 90% of them, I think it is, lose all their money. They lose it because they do not hold an internal blueprint that says, I am worthy of holding on to this kind of money. They literally will self-sabotage themselves because they do not have a belief system that supports that.
Yeah, that is so huge, because what do you do if you are not born into that environment that sets you up for success, whether it be monetarily or happiness? Mm-hmm. What are some of the habits that you can potentially pick up, create for yourself, that is going to lead to increased happiness in your life? Something that you are able to teach yourself because you were never taught that before.
Exactly. And Ian, I have a mother who's like the kind, gentle, loving, nurturing mother, but she has zero. I mean, she just doesn't have love for herself, right? And so the way that that came out was she's very critical. She's genetically wired towards negativity. And so growing up, I had a lot of perfectionism in me. And to this day, I'm extremely critical on myself. I'm getting better, but I think we just don't know how heavy those internal social constructs that were not only taught to us, but modeled through our parents, they
Yes.
can really keep us stuck. And this is not to blame my mom, because as an adult, Ian, it is my work to do. I am 100% responsible for my life. So
Right.
this is not even to put this on my mom, it's on me.
Yeah, so it's not our fault, but it
Right.
is our responsibility to
That is a tweetable moment.
right?
Yes.
Yeah,
Yeah,
absolutely.
exactly. Yeah. And so there's so many habits in the book, but like one of my favorite happiness habits is gratitude, and it falls in the top five of research-based happiness habits that are going to work on that 40%. And I actually think if you do gratitude, if you put a little spin on it, it actually helps you learn to love yourself, because that I always feel like self-love is just the root of our problems, Ian. I feel like it wreaks havoc in every area of our life when we don't know how to extend grace and compassion to ourselves.
Yeah.
But the research says if I can get you to write down three different things that you're thankful for every single day, that somewhere between the days of 21 and 30, I actually create a new neural feedback loop in your brain. I literally change your brain, okay? And the reason this works is that if you're an average human being, we know that you have about 70,000 thoughts a day. And if you're an average human being, 80% of those thoughts are negative.
Negative, yes.
Yeah. So when you and I put our head down on the pillow at night, most human beings have had 56,000 negative thoughts in a day's time. And it's because in caveman, cavewoman times, we had this part of the brain called the amygdala. And the amygdala had one job, which was to constantly scan the environment for negativity or stress in order to keep us safe. Because back then, we had to monitor all the time. Is there a saber-toothed tiger that's going to kill me? Will
Right.
a plan ride in and destroy us? Do we have a water resource or will we die? And so the issue is it's
Survival.
2024. Yeah, survival. It's 2024, and Ian, you still have an amygdala and it's still wired to look for negativity. And
Right.
so we can change that. And so what I challenge people to do, it's a 2-minute daily practice. I tell you, it will change a person's life. But I also would challenge you to make one of those gratitudes something you're thankful for about yourself. And you know what, Ian, when I do this in a workshop and I say, all right, so let's write down one thing that we appreciate about ourselves. Do you know that people can't do it?
It's hard.
It's hard.
Yeah.
It's no longer hard for me, but like it feels very uncomfortable to extend a kindness or a validation or a compliment back to yourself. And it makes me sad that this is how it was for me too. But there's no one that does more for you in a day's time, Ian, than you. Can you not extend a little graciousness back to yourself, you
Yeah.
know? Yeah.
Oh,
So
I have to read because that touches on a quote that you have towards the end of your book, and I love this, and it's by Dr. Vasilia, is it Beninstock? When you're not used to being confident, confidence feels like arrogance. When you're used to being passive, assertiveness feels like aggression. And when you're not used to getting your needs met, prioritizing yourself feels selfish. your comfort zone is not a good benchmark. And that was another, wow, yes, absolutely. And I feel like what you were just talking about, why it's so hard for us to give ourselves a pat on the back or say something that we're proud of ourselves for, or if you're showing gratitude, something has to be, you have to write something down that you're gratitude or gracious about yourself for. It's so difficult because that's outside of our comfort zone.
Exactly.
We're not comfortable doing that. For whatever that reason may be, you may feel like you're bragging, or you may feel like you're, you know, setting yourself up for failure because you have imposter syndrome.
Yep. Yeah. All of those things.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually have, and I'm watching our time here, Ian. I know we're getting close to having to wrap up, but I have a gratitude prompt and tracker that I will email you if any of your listeners want to download it.
Yes, please.
I just use a regular, like, you know, journal to do my gratitudes. But what I like about this particular gratitude prompt and tracker is it gives you 5 prompts where you can begin to look for gratitude in your life so that it gets a little bit easier for you.
That would be great. Yes, I would personally love to have that tool. And I'm sure that our viewers and listeners would love to have that as well. I know that you need to run. I want to just read this last thing because I think it's really impactful. A quote that you have in your book, it says, "Success in any part of life is not just about the goals you want to achieve. It's more powerful to focus on how you want to feel. Then you can make moves that align your life with those feelings."
Yes.
And I was just hoping if you could quickly just kind of unpack that for us.
Yes. I think that we don't focus enough on asking ourselves, at this point in my life, how do I want to feel? And then it's almost like reverse engineering the system, because usually what we do is we create these goals, because we think that, you know, that's going to make us feel a certain way. But like an example of that is I'm 50 and my husband is 58. And that's one of the things that we've been really evaluating, are what are our values at this time in our life? And what do I want to feel more of? And like, I want to feel more ease in my life. Mm-hmm. Ease is a big word for me. I'm not always succeeding at that, because it seems like a little part of my brain thrives in the chaos and the dopamine hits, to be completely honest with you. Sure. So I'm trying to embrace ease, because I also feel like at this stage in my life, it's time to breathe and do things that are like more fun for my husband and I, instead of like always working in this office. Like, we've started playing pickleball because we want to feel like, I want to feel more fun in my life. That's another one, you know? And so it's like, let's start by identifying the feeling that you want first, and then back that out to, if I want to feel more of that, what needs to happen? And then those can become some of your goals.
Yeah, I love that. That is, again, easy or simple to say, simple to think about, but not easy to do. But implemented correctly, it can change the trajectory of your life. That is that is awesome. Kim, thank you so much for joining us on the show. I want to please give you the space here to let our listeners and our viewers know where they can find out more about happiness and more about Kim Strobel.
Yeah. Well, if your listeners are in the education field, the best place to go is strobeleducation.com. And if they are in outside of education, then the website that's going to be the most helpful is kimstrobel.com.
Excellent. I assume the book Teach Happy is everywhere that you can find books?
It is. Yep. You can find it on Amazon.
Awesome.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I appreciate you being here, and I appreciate all of our listeners and viewers that are watching and listening to this episode. I just want to remind you guys that it is so important for you to stay positive, stay persistent, and remember, mindset is everything. We'll see you next time.